All right, so here we are, the second segment. So if you've just clicked on and you've listened to the first one, I'm sure you'll agree it was quite exciting. And what I want to do, I'm here with Max Ucherek, and he's with Max Photographics. And how do you spell that, Max?
M-A-X-X-P-H-O-T-O-G-R-A-F-I-X.
And as we said in the last segment, you're on the first page of Google, both for your name as well as your company name. And what we want to do in this segment, Max, is just basically assume that people have listened to the first segment.
Yep.
And if you can't, and you have access to the first segment, just go ahead and listen to that first if you can, because I think that really lays the groundwork. What I want to talk to you about today is something that we were talking about excuse me, at the Platinum Program Mastermind
yep.
sessions a couple of days ago. And even though people listening to this, if they're not Platinum members, don't have access to that kind of information, because that's our most elite program, as we were having that conversation on that call, it was so vitally important, just like the first segment that we're just referring to previously, and this one, that I did not want to rob everyone else who's not a Platinum member of this key distinction.
Yep.
And because you know the metrics, and you don't have to give any confidential metrics, but you can just give orders of magnitude or give whatever information you're happy to give, is that we were just talking in the previous segment about the degradation of quality perception by people who now have access to digital cameras, and you know, we talked for 20, 25 minutes about that. Assuming that we've agreed that, that's actually occurred over the last 10 to 20 years, but really most forcefully
last
in the last 5 years,
yep.
I want to talk to you about something a little bit more strategic. And the strategic aspect I want to talk to you about is the industry's changed dramatically as a photographer, and everybody's industry has changed. And the reason people would listen to this, and for the reader right now, when you're listening to this, just apply it to your own industry, and you'll see that the things that we discuss are not that dissimilar for so many different industries. And it's the issue of when an industry has a disruptive change, a discontinuous innovation, and a gentleman by the name of Clayton Christensen of the Harvard Business School wrote a book on this called The Innovator's Dilemma. If you go to Amazon, you'll be able to find it, or at Dimmicks in Australia. And what we talk about is a technology that completely disrupts the mechanics of that industry. And so what I'd like to do is you just explain to us between now and 10, 15, 20 years ago, how dramatically different it was, and just use the example, because I know this is the case for many, but just the wedding industry, because weddings are actually an industry, you know, everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people get married, fewer people now than then, but there's still, you know, millions of people getting married. Tell me a little bit about how it was then,
yep.
whenever then was, 10 to 20 years ago. And how it is now.
Well, even
so, start off with the then.
Even 8 years ago.
Okay.
There's a radical difference. The year 2000 to 2001 would have been like peak year.
Really?
That
I would have thought it was like way before that. Okay, so.
No, so about then. And in that year, just to give you an idea, because I still remember my own metrics over the years. The first year I started in business, I shot 2 weddings and thought, gee, this would be great. I'm going to make a lot of money doing this. And second year, 11 weddings. Oh, I can make a bit of money, yeah, on the side.
2 to 11.
Two to 11. The third year, 22 weddings. And then, well, that's a doubling. That's not bad. So I'd like to keep that going. Double it again next year, 42 weddings.
Wow.
And then 104 weddings, so more than double.
So you went from almost one a week to then 104, which is like
two a week.
Wow.
152 the next year. 186, I think it was, the year after that, and then we took on video, so we did 186 weddings and some 30 videos.
Wow.
And some weekends, because it wasn't all in evenly spread through the year, it was very seasonal, and
sure.
So some weekends we had like 13 weddings on, and we would turn over like $30,000-$40,000 in a weekend.
Yeah, 13 weddings in a weekend.
13 weddings, and I had subbies everywhere. And,
of course.
And I used to go into a camera store, and I'd say, I need some film, and they'd go... How much you want? And I go, how much you got?
How much you got?
And I would just clear out the whole cabinet. And someone would come in after me and they go, I want to roll a film. And they go, well, see this guy, he's got it all.
Yeah.
And then it went beyond that to, I couldn't do that anymore, so I started getting direct delivery from my suppliers. So then, you know, I was just on delivery truck. They bring so much equipment out to me because I was using so much. And so the volume of work is just...
So how many pictures would you take on an average wedding?
Usually 500 to 1,000. I think the record is 1,500 an Indian wedding. And they're an event you have to see. They're a 3-day event. So
yeah, I know. I have a friend of mine who's Indian, and he's telling me it's 3 days.
I've got some great Indian wedding stories. Another day.
Sure.
The volume of work is tremendous.
So just clear, an average wedding would be 400 to 500
photos,
pictures.
And you're looking at between $2,500 to $5,000 a wedding.
Yeah.
So multiply that out, that's pretty big business for someone who's just working from home. So I was running a $500,000 a year business out of my lounge room, which I had a garage where I did all my processing, but still, it was still a home-based business. I didn't have to go to work. I could see my kids every day. Fantastic way to live your life.
Sure.
And the good thing about it was also that it was very predictable that people would be seeking my services.
So let me stop you for a second. If someone decided to get married, would they call you then, or... Because you told me something yesterday, which was really surprising.
Because I was mentioning about how many referrals I was doing. Because once I had a booking for someone, and you get into a community like the Indians or the Greeks or very close communities.
Yeah.
So once you build their trust, they will pass your name on to all their family and friends. And so
but they only do that if you're doing an outstanding
job. Because they want someone. They won't refer you because they're very close.
Correct.
Particularly since I'm white Anglo-Saxon and I'm working with people of a totally different ethnic background who are very... mistrustful of other people, particularly the Chinese community. I've done so many Chinese weddings. Again, to have the only white Anglo-Saxon in a wedding of 500 people, because their faith in me was so great from the referral.
And what's important in those communities, and again, this is important, and it's not being racist or anything. It's just that those communities, what they have is they have an ethnic code, a social code, that their referral is their reputation.
Yes, and it reflects badly on them if they...
No, but it's not just on them, their family, their heritage, their whole being. So when someone gives you that referral, it's not just a referral, it's an honorable bestowment of an acknowledgement, almost like winning an award.
Mm.
And I'm not being overly dramatic, because I know a lot of people within those communities, and whenever they give me any kind of an acknowledgement, I honestly... see it as a privileged honor to have. And so when you deal with those communities and you deal with that kind of responsibility, it really is a responsibility that you have to take wholeheartedly.
So back to yesterday's story, where they would then get a referral saying, you have to call Max. If you want your wedding photo shot, you need Max. And so they call me up and they go, we're thinking of getting married next year. And I go, well, I'm booked out 12, 18 months in advance. So, because I had so much work, I'd pre-book 100, 200 weddings for next year, 2 years work in advance. And they say, well, when's your first available day? And I go, October 2010. And they go, how's the 14th? And I go, I'm sorry, I'm booked. I've got the 21st for you. And they go, okay, that's our wedding day.
So they would change, and this is what blew my mind. They would change their
wedding day to get
this
moved.
This is one of the most important days of their lives.
And they would change it to get me.
For you.
Or if they book the church, they ring back and say, I'm sorry, we've got to change our church day. We need Max. We're getting married this day now.
That's unbelievable. And again, for the person who's listening to this right now, when you can command that kind of power, and when I say power, it's literally the power of the delivery of a product that people say, I have to have you. That is created, and that's the discussion for another day. That's what we teach in the Platinum program, in exponential growth strategies and exponential marketing. But when you told me this, I thought, that's amazing, a most important day. Now, why would people have done that? Now, let's just go back to 2000.
Well, there's two things, and I talked a lot earlier on the...
Because you're good.
Yeah, I talked a lot about the technical side of photography, and a lot of people who've tried to come into photography who are great technicians. They know their equipment, they've been through, they've done a degree, but there's a fifth dimension I always taught all the photographers that they need to make the...
Okay, now I know the three dimensions, the fourth dimension's time. Okay. What's the fifth dimension?
Well, the fifth dimension of interpersonal relationships.
Oh yeah, of course.
That these days are not just about photos, they're about sharing part of someone's life, and you have to be part of the celebration of the day.
Yeah.
They look at you more than anyone else during the day. They're looking at your face. You can't expect them to be happy unless you're happy. You can't expect them to be lively unless you're chatty, unless you relate to them, unless they can identify with you as someone they want to spend the happiest day of their life with.
Sure.
They'll spend more time with me than anyone else on the wedding day.
Of course.
And they'll see me before the wedding and after the wedding. And so the relationship I have with them is very important. They have to really like me a lot. And so even beforehand, they come pre-qualified saying, oh, you've got to spend the day with Max, because apart from being a grand photographer, he's just so much fun to be with, you'll find he's not obtrusive, and he's there, he'll get the job done, and you will not remember the fact that you're having photos on the day.
Correct.
You will remember the experience, and the memories afterwards will be the reminder, but you won't remember being a photographic subject. As I do with people taking photos of, I take them quietly from the side.
We were talking in the previous session about a picture you took, and we're under non-disclosure of a peak performance expert in the world, who came to Sydney and gave a presentation over 4 days. So it was a four-day event with, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people at the event, and how when you took all the pictures, that he particularly mentioned how fantastic it was to work with you, because it's about the pictures, because that's the end product. But in many cases, the people that we try to work with as a professional organization are so argumentative, difficult, you know, demanding, just to get to the point where they actually take on the contract, and then they have so many things that they require of the subject that it becomes an insurmountable obstacle, and it becomes exactly that. It becomes a counterproductive, confrontational, antagonistic type of relationship. And in this case, he particularly, personally, made sure that you got the message, as you got,
yes,
and you know that you got that message, that he appreciated the fact that you were flexible and accommodating, and that the photos were gorgeous. But if the photos were gorgeous and you were a pain in the butt, you would never ever film him again.
No.
And that's important. That when, and again, for the person listening to this, is what are the things that you can do to fully optimize, maximize, and exponentialize that fifth dimension of the customer relations.
And it's funny how with referrals, and this often happens as well, where it might have been the first time I've shot a job for someone, and so they've not had previous experience with me. They haven't even seen the result of the job I've done.
Sure.
But they'll come to me at the end of the day, or people have been there saying, can I have your card, or, you know, I'm having an event too. We had such a nice time with you today.
Sure.
I said, you haven't seen the photos yet. I said, we don't care.
Yeah.
We're sure they'll be fine, but just spending a day with you,
correct,
that was the experience. That, that's
and
memorable.
You see, when in this segment, what we're talking to you about, and we're talking again with Max Ucherek of Max Photographics, is a lot of people think, if they're a photographer, that the product is this print that's right here, or this DVD, or this CD. They think that that's the product. So people think that, oh, I sell software, or I sell a chair. I'm a chair manufacturer, or I'm a horticulturalist because I sell plants. Well, no, actually you don't. What you actually sell is this fifth dimension we're talking about, is the experience, the personal relationships. And you've been exemplary in this. But what I want to focus you on again, and you know, your
back
passion.
Back to the industry, yes.
Yeah, but your passion for this, and the person who's listening to this is going, boy, this guy really loves taking pictures. And the reason we're having this conversation is because of two things. One is, well, several things, but the two ones is you have this amazing passion. And I know it gets captured, you know, in the auditory sense. Your passion visually as a photographer is exemplary. But the other thing is you can articulate things like very few people can. So I want to take you back to the industry for a second.
Okay, so hang on, before
you do that,
okay.
I got to hold this guy back. It's unbelievable. And this is great because, you see, when you bring that in, and again, if you're listening to this, is you want to have this kind of passion. Now, this is Sunday morning for us, right?
Yes.
And look,
after a long day yesterday.
Yeah, and after a long day yesterday, we're filming one of our events. And we're here early because we have this passion and we want to give this gift to the listener. And this gift is that if you have this passion, and if we go back to 2000, back then, there was a certain dynamic. And back then, just to recap real quick, is that people would change their dates around because they just wanted to have you. So they would say, okay, you're available on the 17th. They say, okay, we're going to get married on the 17th. They changed their church, their reception and everything for that day. Now, that was then.
Yep.
Because that was then. Now we're in 2008, and things have changed a little bit.
Things have changed, and I said the other day that there was notable change, because I'm a real statistics freak, so I keep numbers and everything. And I kept numbers. It's funny, I know I've done 1,600 weddings, because I numbered the first wedding number one, and I've numbered them ever since.
You've done how many?
1,600.
1,600?
Weddings.
Wow.
In some 20 years. So
it's
a lot of days out on a weekend.
Now, if you're listening to this, you should have those kinds of statistics so that you could say something like that, but that's amazing.
So
I think you know a little bit about photographs.
I've taken and printed over a million photos.
That's another statistic.
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
And the machine keeps stats on me as well, so I know how many.
Yeah, of course.
I've done. But we're back to the difference between 2000 when, you know, there was such a boom.
Yeah.
And back to my stats, 9/11 was an amazing day that changed the world in many ways.
Yeah.
And according to my stats, and this is really strange because I kept stats not only of my monthly income, but, and also, you know, the number of referrals, and also, you know, how many forward bookings there were.
Yeah, we call that managed by metrics.
So I knew what was coming up and how big it was and how much to plan for. But also, at any one time, I knew how much forward work was waiting for me and how my conversions were going, how many people I talked to. After 9/11, there was an instant 30% drop off from that month to the number of both inquiries, of conversions, of people interested in getting married. The industry dropped in an instant by 30%. Now, why, I don't know. Was it because people didn't want to trust the honeymoon overseas anymore, or they wanted to focus more on their family life, or they realised their own mortality, or how dangerous it was, they wanted to put their money into their house rather than on a big wedding? Whatever the reason was, I don't know. And all I know is the result was a change in the numbers, and the numbers dropped 30% instantly from that point on, never recovered. Now, I tried to counter that by increasing all the things you do, which is, you know, more advertising, you know, more contact. Despite the fact I ploughed another $50,000 that year into all the things I've been doing in previous years, thinking that it would counter the loss, it didn't counter the loss. And it dropped 30% despite the counter movement I'd made. And so I had to start thinking that...
It's not because you stopped doing 30% of stuff, you actually increased
it to try and counter the difference.
Now, this is one of those exponential strategies we talk about, and this is where we're gonna explore that a little bit more in this conversation, is that most people, and you did this back then because that's what most people do, and again, you know, if you want to do things out of the ordinary, you have to do things that no one else does, right? We talk about anti-mimetic isomorphic behavior. But that happened, and that was 2001, obviously September 11th, 2001. We're now 7 years later.
Yep.
How has the industry still changed, evolved,
well, regressed? Well, there've been so many changes, and so many people in large sectors of the industry have just been left gobsmacked by the change. And I don't know if you realize, some of the biggest names in photography, like Agfa in Europe, out of business. No more film, no more paper. Konica, gone. Sold their interest to Sony. Minolta, sold their business to Sony. Kodak pulled out of Australia, no more manufacturing of in Australia. Black and white paper, gone, no longer being made, you've got to do it all digital. All these elements, and I think Fuji is thinking of going into medical imaging rather than doing film, because all these major players in the industry have gone, we can't make a dollar in this anymore, because no one is getting prints anymore. Everyone's gone digital, they see it on their screen, or they don't convert to print, they take photos that are of dubious quality. They quickly put them on their screen, and this is something that I don't know if anyone's ever realised, and being in the printing industry, you go into McDonald's and you see those beautiful backlit photos of a burger.
Yeah.
Backlit photos look great, and they always have.
Sure, because the light's in the back.
The light's in the back, and it comes through and it livens it up. And it's always been the same in the past. If you did a tranny and looked through it, it looked fantastic.
Sure.
You put it to print, it looks terrible.
Yeah.
And what's happened is people are seeing all these images on a computer screen, they're all backlit. They're beautiful on the screen because they've got the life of the light coming through it. You put it out to print and see what it's like for real, and you go, oh my god, what's wrong with this print?
Yeah.
The quality's not there. Screens look great, they're 72 dpi and it covers up a lot of errors. You put 72 dpi on paper and suddenly you go, oh, that's rubbish.
Yeah.
And so many people are being fooled by what they see on the screen. If all they're going to do is see things on the screen, well, that's great, that's their end result. If they take that now and put it on their 1080p flat screen, they'll suddenly realise how bad it is when you suddenly start to see the pixelization.
Yeah, what's going to happen is the current quality of what people are looking at is going to only increase, and therefore the poor quality is only going to be more and more accentuated in the future. But getting back to the whole industry thing, is it's obviously decimated the photographic industry.
And I
grew up, when I say grew up, I worked since I was 15 years of age in the printing industry. So, you know, making photocopies and blueprints, you know, actually called white prints, you know, with the ammonia smell and all that, doing black and white and color enlargements and microfiche. Remember microfiche?
Yeah.
Right?
Blue screen.
Right? And you go to the library and you see old newspapers, right? You know, right, pre-internet kind of stuff. You know, key punch cards and all that kind of stuff. So I go way back and I'm only 45, but sometimes I feel like I'm 100 because the acceleration of technological change has just been dramatic. And the reason we're having this conversation is, how do you deal with this rapid, and the photographic industry is particularly one that's been affected, how do you deal with this dramatic change now in 2008 when all of a sudden the whole industry's changed? And the reality is, just so that we're clear, is yes, there are fewer people getting married, okay? But even though there's fewer people getting married, and let's say, I don't know the statistics, but let's say there are 30% fewer people getting married. In fact, there's 30% fewer people getting married, but people are getting married more often, so they have multiple weddings, right? So 25 years ago, people, or 30 years ago, they'd get married once. Now, a lot of people are getting married two or three or four
times. Well, I've been in the business long enough, and this is, again, a terrible statistic to have, is that they come back for the second or third try,
yeah.
and they excuse themselves and they say, well...
Oh, we just wanted better pictures?
Well, Max did my last partner's wedding, I hope you don't mind, but this is my new guy.
Yeah.
And so they're fine about it. So I call them retreads.
Yeah.
which is a terrible thing to say, and they have a laugh, I tell them that. But they're fine about it because they liked the job 5-10 years ago.
Sure.
And they bring the new partner along and say,
yeah.
Max did
and of course, they say, hey, listen, that's fine. As long as you make me look as young as the first wedding, right?
Yeah.
But if the industry's changed so much, because the person listening to this is saying, okay, what's in it for me? Because that's what everybody's looking for. And even though they're passionately engaged in their conversation right now, what's in it for me is the industry's changed. You're like a fish out of water, but you've been swimming in this pond or in this ocean for, in your case, 20 years, and you're going, what the hell's going on? How do I deal with it? Weddings are still taking place. Someone's still taking the pictures. So what's going on? Do you just pack up and go home? Well, you're home anyways.
Hmm.
So you just stay home and just say, well, I'm just going to stay home now, and that's it. I'm just going to give up. Or is there another way to look at it? How do you see the industry now, and how do you... Because... I was telling you something coming up the escalator, remember?
Yeah.
And I said, we're talking about the last man standing. Now, if an industry has these dramatic changes, there's always what's called the last man standing, and not to be sexist, the last person standing, right? But it's an expression. To be the last person standing means that you do something that no one else does, and you're, in your case, you're one of the best people doing what you do. So if there was one last person standing, you should be that person. I know you are, but what I mean when I say you should, not that you're not. So if you should be that person and you are that person, what is it that you're doing? How do you see these dramatic changes as an advantage that you can leverage versus the threat, and how that threat could potentially give you a, not a monopolistic, but a privileged position in this industry, whereas everyone else can't necessarily react to those changes?
Well, one of the things I've always had that's been working in the background that people don't even realize that I was doing, and that is my passion for the quality of what I was doing. So
yeah.
at every stage, and I've always owned my own lab, so I can't stand other people's printing. And again, even though we don't do as many prints now, the final correction of a photo has been the most important part. So however
sure.
it's taken, you know, the last adjustment, your book of 52 steps in, you know, adjusting things, how much adjustment has to go in to get it just right.
Right.
And when people have seen my work in the past, other photographers looked at it, they look through page after page and they go, yeah, perfectly exposed, perfectly printed photo, page after page after page. If it's on screen, the same thing. Every photo is corrected, every photo looks as it should do to my eye, which is, you know, hopefully trained over many years of knowing what a photo should look like.
Well, I hope after a million pictures.
Yeah, you think you get an idea of how it's done. So that quality is always built in. But what I think has happened in the industry is people have lost sight of quality. And I haven't been there to necessarily educate everyone, and they've accepted a far lower level on the basis that, oh, this will do because I've got an image, rather than showing them how an image can look. And I might go back to the previous discussion we had about what got me into photography, seeing a meter square image that was taken and going, wow, that is just amazing. The quality and detail on that is just superb. And so that's sticking in my mind to this day. I wonder how many people have an image in their mind of a photo of that standard, or is the thing they're used to the sort of thing you get as a little, you know, wallet-sized photo or a little 6x4, or the fading photo in a frame that's been sitting there in the sunlight, you know, for 10 years, and look around your room, you'll see there are photos that are red and pink and green, and some are bleached.
My mother actually just recently, I received it for my birthday, sent me a photo of me at age, I believe it was, three, maybe three and a half, and I'm sitting in my great-grandfather's lap. Now, when he passed on, he was 93 years old. Okay, so I was very privileged to actually, you know, meet, and I remember vaguely, because I was, you know, very young when he passed away, a 93-year-old man who was an absolute lover of children and of the human spirit, and that's all I remember him. He was just an exceptional human being. And he's holding us, because there's my brother and my sister on the couch, and he's holding my brother, and I'm right next to him, and we're playing. So here's this 93-year-old man, very distinguished person, and we're kids playing on the couch, and he's just like a little kid playing with us. And that picture was taken like 40 years ago, and she did a copy of it, or made a copy of it, and sent it to me. She didn't send it to me electronically. She sent it to me as a print. And this print is actually, this reprint is actually pretty good quality. That's priceless to me.
Hmm.
So it's not a 49-cent print or a 29-cent print or a 79-cent print. That print, I can relive that experience. And I was three and a half years old. And I can relive it. And what a lot of people forget is you're not selling prints. And I'm not saying that you think this, but we, and the person listening to this, you don't sell a print. What I'm getting from that, all the way from Canada, now living in Australia,
you're getting a memory.
My mother is doing one thing, is she's thinking about me.
Hmm.
Second, she's gone through the process of actually getting a print done, making a copy, and sending it to me. Now I get this, so I know she sent it to me, so now I feel connected to my mother. Then I get this print, and it says my great-grandfather, who's a very special person in my life, because he was one of the mentors that I had, or still have in my spiritual life, and I look at this and I can see that we're having fun, and I can see that what's important in life is to actually enjoy being who you are. And for him, he loved children, and he loved the fact that we were his offspring, and that we were playful little kids. And you know, I think we're relatively well behaved, at least on that day, because you know, we're kids. And capturing that moment is just an unbelievable thing. Now, that happened to be a picture taken by a family member. But the reason I'm telling you this is because here we're talking with Max Chicharik, you know, an infamous Sydney photographer. But it's about what you create as that emotion. And you can tell my tonality's changed because I'm right back in that moment again. And we as business people, if we ever forget that, we deserve to lose 60-70% of the business.
Oh, I've always said that
photography is
a motive business. It's
but every business is. This happens to be more emotive because you do things that are more closely attached to emotional events.
Well, thinking about what you said then about, you look back to an age-old photo and how it's reliving memories from that time.
Sure.
And I was going to do two quick changes of time. Imagine what it's going to be like in 50 years' time when your children or offspring are looking back to the photos that you took,
yeah,
and they're going, what the hell were you thinking? What are these?
Oh, that was the digital era. Boy, was that a mess. That was just like the clothes in the 1970s, right? The bell-bottom pants.
And how far have we come in that time, and what were you guys doing in that time?
God, well, I hope it gets better, Max.
Well, I'm going to take you back 150 years or so to the American Civil War. And this is, I love this story because it's so relevant to today. Back then when photography was invented, they had photos of all the North versus South troops fighting each other. They were taken on glass plates that were a pane of glass 10 inches square. Massive negative.
Yeah.
Big sheet of glass. You could just use a contact print of it. The detail was so superb because a negative that's 10 inches square, then the most expensive commercial camera you can now use is the same size, 10 by 8 inch, will give you the best quality. So in 150 years, we've come nowhere from the American Civil War, so the best cameras are still 10 by 8. The tragedy of the Civil War
was... A little embarrassing, don't you think?
and these are beautiful shots. And if you look at photos of the day, they are so superbly sharp. And the contrast and detail, fantastic. Compared to digital photos today, you're looking at what rubbish. But the real tragedy of the Civil War was that they had all this glass and all these photos. And what are they going to do with them all? And they were either broken, or the greatest story I love is the one of the glass house that they built out of the glass plates. So what are they going to do with all this glass? So I thought, well, we can put it to good use. They built a glass house for horticulture, and it would have been the most amazing sight of looking around at these negative images of the Civil War surrounding wall to wall, but the tragedy of that was that they all faded in the sunlight. So that all these beautiful negatives,
oh my God, yeah, I was gonna
just
say
part of history just disappeared,
yeah,
as
the UV
sunlight,
rays, yeah,
sunlight, and it turned back to ordinary glass. And they thought, oh great, we've got our glass back. Faded into nothing, all these gorgeous images that can't be repeated. Here we are today doing the same thing. We have got all these images that are fading away to nothing, that in 50 years' time our kids will look back at the tragedy of the digital age today.
But hang on a sec, you said fading away to nothing, but these are digital, so they never change. So tell me a little bit about what we talked about in the first segment of this interview.
Okay, so lots of ways you can use digital image. What's it recorded on? I mean, in the last 5 years, how many changes of media have there been? Going from CD to DVD, now to Blu-ray.
No, hang on a sec. We start off with mini floppy disks, remember?
Yes, and we had 5 1/4. We had 8-inch floppy.
Yeah, 8-inch. They went to 5 1/4, they went to 3.5.
We used to also record on tape.
Yeah.
In sequential. Sure. Anyone's got anything stored on that? Lost. Where are you going to find a tape player? Where are you going to find an 8-inch, 5-inch floppy player these days?
VHS.
Right. All going. And so the migration technology, every few years we're changing technologies, and all those photos that you had, no one's upgraded them, no one's transferred them, they're all sitting there.
And sometimes when you go from one format to the other, sometimes you actually lose quality.
Yeah,
if it's digital to digital, you might not. I don't want to be overly dramatic, but if you go from VHS and you bring it onto a DVD, you're going to lose quality because it's the next generation.
So all this stuff, if you haven't upgraded it, at some point it's going to be out of technology and no one will be able to access it. Or people don't realise that dies in burnable CDs and DVDs do eventually fade.
Sure.
Or if you scratch the thing, that's the end of it and there's no recovery, it's very hard to get back. Or your hard disk is corrupted, is everyone backed up?
Sure.
Mark, you were saying earlier, you have a fire. Lose the whole lot. Doesn't matter what it's on. If it has a fire, it's gone. So all these technologies and all of our history for the last 5, 10, 15 years is all stored in media that's constantly either being degraded or changing format, or if you don't upgrade soon, it'll be beyond recovery. And our kids will look back to, no mum, I can't put your 5-inch CD into my laser cube player. It just won't go. And so whatever the technology of the day is, they're going to look back and go, you guys really should have.
And that's just as bad as the house going up in flames and the photos being burnt. It's the same thing.
Same thing, or the glass house losing.
Yeah, the glass house, yeah. Now, getting back to the industry, because the person who's listening to this wants to know, what do they do in this situation of such massive, upsetting, emotional, gut-wrenching change? What do they do? What have you done? And what are some of the things that you see, and then I'll add a few exponential ideas.
Well, first thing I did is go back and try and re-educate myself about what's happening in the marketplace, and talk to people and see what they're doing, and look for what the opportunities might be out there, but also re-educating myself in here talking with Mark and going on courses and trying to find out different ways of marketing myself, different things that I need to look for in people, learn about my customer. And to be able to segment them and see that there are...
Well, relearn about your customer.
Yes, because I'm going to have to revisit what it is they're thinking and all the things we're learning about different personality types and how they should be treated and how different people are either auditory or they're visual. How do I relate to the different segments in terms of the age groups? So many things I'm learning about. It's not just one market out there. There's so many different people at the target in different ways, and everyone responds in different ways. So to me, my re-education and researching what's out there is important to me, and so I have to pick up my game and learn as much as I can about that. And to me, Mark, I have a different system view. I can't recall the 4-point thing you always do.
Oh, the 4 keys to success.
because I'm trained as a plan, do, check, act.
Plan, do, check, act. Okay.
Which is very similar to the one that you always do, but it's a 4-word one for me.
Sure. Just so people know, the first one is know your outcome, second is take action, third is find out what works and what doesn't, and four is realign until you achieve number one, which is your outcome, and then the loop's back.
Okay. So plan, do, check, act for me is the short version of that.
Whatever works for you.
It does the same for me. It's much quicker. So I'm currently very much in my planning research analysis phase.
Yeah.
Another sideline here, I'll show you background. I trained as an architect. I'm really a designer by profession.
Really? I'm learning so much about you. You're an archery. You're an what do you call it?
I'm a master bowman in archery.
Master bowman in archery. So you almost made the Olympics.
Almost made the Olympics. Yes.
That's amazing.
I actually in indoors I beat the Australian Olympic representative over 18 metres. I was unbeatable in Sydney for many years over a short distance. Different story.
Yeah.
Many awards.
Now, you see, the reason I triggered that in you is just to make sure that the person who's listening to this, if you have anything that's that unique, you want to bring that in, because now I can talk to people about you in a different way. I can now articulate how you go for the shot, just like an archer does, and I can use that metaphor every once in a while when appropriate. One, because it demonstrates that you have discipline. It shows that you have commitment. It means that you're multidimensional. The fact that have you done architectural courses?
Yeah, of course.
Are you an actual architect?
No, I haven't done my professional year, but I have a degree from Sydney University.
Architectural design. Yeah. See, I didn't know that. So now I can say that not only do you have an architectural degree, but you're a Bowman. I have to learn this.
Master Bowman.
Master Bowman in archery.
Yes.
Okay, Master Bowman in archery. So I'll commit that to memory. Now all of a sudden you're not just a photographer. I mean, you never were just a photographer. But again, if you're listening to this, is you're not just anything. And if that's all you got listening to this segment for another 30 minutes or so, is that that's all you got, that is priceless. Because what I see in what we've been discussing, both in this segment and the segment that preceded it, is in crisis there's opportunity. And what I see, and that's just my exponential mindset thinking, you know, that I got from Anthony Robbins and from Brian Tracy and from Albert Einstein, is that if you think out of the ordinary thoughts, you're going to get extraordinary results. And then the crisis and the opportunity right now that I think is exemplary in the photography space is that in as much as, let's just say that the wedding market is dramatically different for all the reasons that we discussed both in this segment and the preceding segment, and the advent of what we call a disruptive technology that Clayton Christensen of the Harvard Business School talked about that dramatically upsets and revolutionizes an industry in the introduction of the digital camera, both the digital photo camera and the digital video camera, you could think, again, if you're like the herd, everyone says, oh my God, this is terrible, I'm out of this industry. But the reality is there's this new resurgence, and this is what I want to talk to you about, and this is my gift to you for the time that we spent this morning, Max.
Can I sneak in just one little thing?
Oh, I can't hold back your passion, and I love that about you. And if you're listening to this, you can tell that
I've got to get it out.
I know you got to get it out. You should see his face; it's red, and he's got the veins in his forehead because you want to give this gift, right?
Well, you've got to get this because back's the reason I brought in the architect.
See, I don't want to hold you back.
No. Because the first thing you learn in architecture in doing design is analysis. Analyze the hell out of things. You've got to do your research. It's like putting a building on sand. You've got to know what the client wants. You've got to work your way through all the needs, their needs analysis. You've got to work your way through all the structures. 1,000 things you've got to research first. You don't do your design until you've done all your analysis work.
Correct.
I've got to say this correctly. If you say this wrong, you're in big trouble. You have to be careful of making premature evaluations. You only get that wrong.
Yeah, premature evaluations, yes.
When you've done all your research, and there's this stage that architects go through, and it's so hard because you hope for it to come, and it's what they call cognitive jump, where you've taken all your analysis, and at some point you have to synthesize this into a solution. How you get that jump, how do you go from all your research into this is what I'm going to do as a final result in order to keep my customer happy, in order to satisfy their needs on 100 different dimensions.
Sure.
How do I bring all those things together to produce something that they will look at and go, it's aesthetically pleasing, it's what I want to spend money on, it's where I want to live, it's where I'm going to be happy growing up with my kids, it's where I want to show my friends, it's where I want to live my life.
Socially and conscious, all that.
A thousand different dimensions as to what I've had to put into that design that comes out of all the analysis. And with what's happening now with my look at the photographic industry and where I've been, I'm very much still in the analysis phase, looking very closely at when I'm going to make that cognitive jump. What is my design solution going to be? What are the things what am I going to do by taking all the elements of what I've learned, how am I going to bring those together, and Mark, how am I going to twist the cube in order to put together a solution that will best suit all of the research I've done so far, that will give an outcome that I don't have to tear down. Right? So good building a building and going, well, you don't like that, I'll rip it down and do another one.
Yeah.
You don't
want
to do all the work
again. Or put an addition that just looks like a mess. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So you
kind of looks like Heathrow Airport.
Yeah. So the hard part, though, is premature evaluations, to not run in with an answer. And some people say, oh, you're a procrastinator. No. Sure, I've got lots of ideas. I'm putting those aside. I note those down. I make a note of them. Maybe
so what's the difference between a procrastinator and someone who doesn't want to make that premature evaluation? What's the key for you?
To me, when you have your design sketchbook, you're always writing down ideas. So even though you're doing your evaluations, you're sketching possibles.
Good.
And you're constantly putting down, maybe I can do this, maybe I can do that. You don't suddenly go down that path, but you don't put aside any of those...
Go ahead.
Any of those little cognitive jumps, you make a note of them because you may want to investigate them further. You may get the answer early on. It may be the first one. It may be the middle. It may be the last one. You don't know. But until you're happy at the point where you've done enough research that you're going to pick one of those.
So a procrastinator is just waiting.
Yeah.
You're just putting it off. I'll worry about it later. Whereas what you're doing is you're actively, proactively engaged in the process of evaluating.
And you're also evaluating by doing, I can't do the other version, your PDCA cycle. Okay, so you've made a little plan. You do it. You say, how did that turn out? Can I do better than that? Can I change that? Go back, change your plan. Do the cycle again and again. And I like to think of it, the great visual of this, of a wheel rolling uphill in steps.
Yeah.
The PDCA cycle goes, every time you do a full cycle, you take a step up, small or large, to the next level of performance.
Correct.
And so a lot of people are looking for that massive breakthrough leap at the end.
Yeah, the big payoff, the big windfall, the lottery ticket.
Yeah, this is it, and this will be the solution.
Here's a dollar, I'm going to make a million, that thought.
Whereas with Mark, as he puts it, as exponential growth, and I put it in terms of small step changes constantly.
Sure.
You're constantly taking all your research, putting forward ideas, having a little market test, doing little things, trying them out, seeing how it goes. Doesn't work, change your plan. Go back around again, do something different, see how you can work it. So I'm not looking at doing the big building at the end up front.
Correct.
I'm doing little bits at a time, seeing how they're going, making wins.
But you agree that at some point you have to build the building.
You do.
At some point
you've got to do it, but these are all your little trials along the way. So you're trying to reaffirm your decision-making process to see if those small decisions are then worthwhile pursuing to a greater degree. Procrastinators would sit there and go, I'll make the decision at the end and hope for the big windfall. But no, you're not doing that. You're still researching, but at the same time, you're still working and trying things and hoping all the time that in this process, somewhere in there may be the big payoff in one massive idea, but failing that, along the way, you don't just sit there. You're going to make a small change gains all along the way. Eventually, you'll get there.
Using the architectural metaphor, as you build this magnificent building, the fact that you might win an international award, that's just gravy.
Hmm.
But this is a home, this is a building that you want to live in, for the rest of your life or for the next 5 years or 10 years, or you want to bring up your family in this home or you want to, have your head office in this building, to use the architectural metaphor. The fact that you win or not win that architectural award, that everyone goes, wow, what a magnificent piece of architecture, that's an aside. And in business, it's the same thing. A lot of people that I come across, they're looking for that big win. They're looking for that award-winning project, if you will, or that account. And in fact, that's not how you get rich. You get rich by 1%, 1%, 1% every day. One of the things that that we're teaching in a Platinum program that we've been talking to you about is, one of the things that you have is you have an asset, and the asset is everything that you've done for the past 20 years. And we're talking previously, before the recording, as well as in the previous segment, about some of the things that can be done. And one of the things that we were talking about is everybody has what are called hidden assets in their business, and those hidden assets in their business are things that they don't value at the full, I don't like to use the retail value, but the full perceptual and actual value that the client who will benefit from it can actually value it at. So if I give you an example of that photograph, if someone says, okay, I've got that photograph, and let's assume that, like we were talking about before, is those are someone has pictures that I've never seen of the same time that I was with my great-grandfather, and that those pictures, there's 10 of them. Now, those 10 prints at a dollar each are worth $10, but I'd pay $100, $200, $500 for those pictures, because to me, they're actually priceless. Now, I won't pay $55 million for them, but I will pay a substantially higher multiple because they're worth it to me. Now, if you ask my sister or my brother, regardless of economic ability to pay, That's not the discrepancy. If you ask my brother and sister, if I was willing to pay $500, maybe my brother would be willing to pay $300. Maybe my sister would be willing to pay $700 or $800, because we have different evaluations of that value. Do you understand?
Yeah. Well, I went through a lot of those processes.
But those prints only worth $10.
I went through a lot of processes about what I was worth when I went through that. Did that sequence of photos by year, how the business grew. When I was doing like two weddings a year, had no faith or confidence in myself because I hadn't sold one yet. So the first job, what do you sell it for?
Sure.
So it was a giveaway. It was like $200.
Yeah.
You know, just get me out there to get the first job so I've got some record of it. And then tested the market by constantly putting my prices up, seeing what people would pay. And so my first big psychological barrier was $1,000. I think that was around the 40 wedding a year mark when I got up to that point. I thought, no one's going to pay $1,000.
Sure, back then.
Yeah, back then, it was a lot of money. Yeah, and so finally broke the ice, went past 1,000 people would pay it, and the work kept coming in. 1,500, 2,000, 2,500, 3,000, 3,500. The biggest single wedding package I ever sold was $10,000 to a Chinese couple. And that gives you some real confidence when you can constantly say, you know, I'm worth $10,000 for a weekend's work.
And sure.
That's great.
But it's because it's not just a weekend's work. It's 20 years of expertise.
Experience that goes into that,
right.
And they wanted me for the job. But I had to have the belief in myself that I could do that. And look, just one more story about belief in yourself, because I talk a lot about referrals and about how important they are to the business. And I got into the Indian community after doing one wedding, which took 3 days and 1,500 photos, and they were very thankful. So they kept referring all their Indian and Chinese friends to me, so that big Chinese community doing all those. And one after another, it was a phone call. Oh, there's another referral from good friend Sudha. Good on you, Sudha, if you hear this. This guy, Kiru, came one day and said, look, it's an Indian wedding, it's 5 days, but my fiancée lives in London, and we can only do one reception out here. The other 4 days are in London. So I said, that's fine. And so we finished the interview, and This is where you should really be clear about things sometimes. He called me back the next day and said, when you said that's fine, what did you mean? Did you mean it's fine, you can only do the 1 day? He said, no, I'll do the London part too. He said, really? I said, oh, great. So, excellent. Some people say, you know, do you travel out past Penrith or do you go to Wollongong? And I love this story because I go, no. Look, I'll go anywhere.
Yeah.
And so when I turned up in London to shoot the other 4 days of the wedding, he was going, you've flown to London? Yeah, absolutely, because I'll go anywhere. I mean, if the work is there.
Sure.
And what that gave me, it gave me a two-week trip to London, which is great, and the important part was that the credibility it gave me then with other customers.
Sure.
Well, I could show them photos of a job I shot in London, and when they say, do you travel to North Sydney? Okay, do I travel to North Sydney? Have I got a story to tell you?
Yeah, exactly.
And I show them the photos and go, I'll go anywhere.
Now, we all have those stories, because... And if we don't, then you need to create them. But we all have those stories, and just whoever's listening to this is probably an experienced individual, and it can even be stories of other industries. And what's important is for you to leverage that. And what we'll do is we'll figuratively end the conversation now, and I want to thank you. And then we're going to continue for another 5-10 minutes, and I'm going to give you some special ideas. So Max Ucherek from Max Photographics, we've given you the information at the beginning of the segment. I want to thank you for this segment. And then we'll add this other bonus segment in just a minute. So thank you very much for spending time today.
Mark.